Good morning. So as Doug said, we're going to be finishing up part two of Joseph, the Joseph story. So if you weren't here a couple weeks ago, hopefully this will still make sense. You know, the Joseph story was a young man sold into slavery by his brothers and then coming to power. And I'm not going to recap that. That sermon's online. It's crazy long, like an hour. it was too much. But this is going to kind of wrap that up. I have had a cold since last week, so but I am feeling better today. I'm on the tail end of it, so praise God for that. Yeah, basically this, you know, if you're new here, we've been going through this big story of creation, fall, redemption, and restoration. And so as a reminder, as we go through these narratives and these stories, we're looking at the forest and not the trees so much, and we're really trying to get a broad overview and a survey. And we want to move at a fast pace so we can kind of get through the broad story of the big story and all of what God has done from creation and all the way through. So we're moving very fast, and that means we're going to skip a lot of stuff, and a lot of good stuff is going to get skipped too. So don't be upset if we skip past things that you're like, I can't believe you didn't talk about that. We're just doing our best to cover the broad narrative. And today we'll be just wrapping up this idea that we talked about last time of God meaning it for good, of God's sovereignty, of God using things for good in the lives of his people. Many of you may know the story of Jim Elliot and Nate Saint and these guys. End of the Spear was a movie that came out not super long ago. It's a good film worth watching if you don't know their story. But basically there were five guys and there were families: Jim Elliot, Roger Udarian, Ed McCauley, Pete Fleming, and Nate Saint. And their families began to have a burden for this tribal group in Ecuador that loves to cruise around, that were just a violent people. And they felt the burden of Revelation 5, 9, and 10, where it speaks of the blood of the Lamb having ransomed people from every tribe and language and nation and people group. And they began to get together as families and pray for these people, the Wadani people. And this particular group was in danger, almost of possibly becoming extinct, because there was an oil company there. As oil company workers would go into these territories, they would kill off anyone who set foot in their territory, these tribals. And so people would go in there and just not come out. And so as this oil company would go to the government, they wanted these people dealt with. On top of that, this tribe was said by anthropologists to have been one of the most violent they had ever studied in history. They had a 60% homicide rate. So not only were they killing off other tribes and people outside of their territory, they were killing each other off constantly. Nate Saint had a son, Steve Saint, who would later say that of anyone his age within this tribe, he didn't meet a single person whose father died of natural causes. So they were just a super violent people and in danger of being eradicated through just this life of violence. These families began to feel that burden, that God has promised that every tribe will be represented in heaven, and that he's going to redeem people from every people and language. And so they began to feel the call and the burden of God's heart for the nations to take the gospel to this warring tribe. And so one particular individual within this group, Nate Saint, he would be the pilot in the group. And they had to devise a way to try to build relationship with the people there, because you couldn't just walk in. Anybody who tried that before would fail. And so Nate Saint is just an interesting guy, this brilliant young man who would invent things from a young age. He'd build these things for boats. He ended up as a pilot building a new kind of a seat belt that would be safer, and a new reserve tank for these small planes. And he was just a really gifted and intelligent person. And God, as you look at his life, you could see God preparing him and gifting him for this calling. And one of the things that he came up with as he was thinking of how do we get things to these tribal people when we can't just walk in there, And so he, thinking about it one day, I think he had a string and a piece of pencil, a pencil, and he was thinking about the plane and how they might drop things down. And he invented this thing called the spiral line technique, where he would fly the plane at a specific speed in a circle, and a line would be dropped all the way down to the ground. And when he did it just right, the bucket would just hang in one place, and the people on the ground could actually go and grab things out and put things back in. And I watched the demonstration of this by his son, Steve, doing this technique, and you can watch the bucket just sitting there on the ground momentarily. It's amazing. So this guy was brilliant. Not only that, as they were supporting missionary families out in the jungle who were in remote areas where they couldn't land and no one could get to them, there were no communications. A lot of times the people would be sick, and he invented a way to use a telephone line that would drop from the airplane with a telephone on the other end, and they would literally do this technique, find out what the ailments were of the people on the ground in the jungle, go back, get the antibiotics or whatever they need, and drop them down in the bucket. So just a brilliant guy. And I say all of that and kind of establish that those things about him, because I believe that when you look at his life, you see the calling. When you look at all of these lives, you see the calling of these people, and you see the gifting that God was preparing them for all these years, with all the giftings and all the ways they were wired and even the things they enjoyed doing, to be able to be used in these ways. And I think the picture that it paints for me especially is that God calls people, and he's going to use us, and he's going to use our gifts, and he's going to work through his people, and he's going to accomplish all of his purpose without question. But it doesn't always go the way that we think it's supposed to go. It doesn't always turn out quite like we would have planned it, because as these families went out there, wives and children, and began to establish a rapport with these people and felt like things are going good, because now after the third time, I think they were dropping the bucket, the tribal started to take the gifts out of these buckets, and they started to put things back, and they kept doing this. And so they even had a time where Nate Saint had been able to figure out a way to fly a plane in and land it just right where he pretty much drops on the sand bank of a river, you know, beach in the jungle. I mean, he was just this amazing pilot. And so all this gifting, so he could be able to land on a beach and do these things. And they had this day where they connected with a few of the tribals, and it was positive. And so the guys get in their plane, and they're excited as they see a group wandering down on a trail near this beach where they figured out they could land in the jungle. As they got there, they were excited, but rather than a warm welcome, the group came at them with spears. And if you know the story, they were speared and hacked. They had guns. They could have defended themselves, but they weren't there to do that. And so these five men surrendered their lives. These tribals would even throw their bodies in the river, which in that culture was a disgrace, so they could be eaten by fish and turtles. And so there was this real act of hatred and vengeance and violence in this whole thing. And it just paints this picture of how God works things out, because here you got this guy who's got all this gifting. You think, what a brilliant guy, what an amazing pilot. Wow, he invented all these things. And when you look at it, he did a lot of things along the way, but so much of it was set up so that he could land this plane with this group of guys so they could lay down their lives on this beach. And it's not the way we would like plan that. And I'm going to come back to that in a little bit. But basically, when we've been thinking about the life of Joseph, if you were here last time and even as we wrap up, it's basically the same idea. That God does things often in a way that we would have never wrote the story that way. And we certainly wouldn't write our story that way. Filled with suffering, filled with struggle, filled with despair and times of hopelessness, and filled with pain and agony and broken relationships and all of these things. And yet God brings about his purposes, as we saw last time, even through the evil actions that take place in the world. And so this speaks about God's sovereignty and about his control and his way of working with the affairs of men in the world. So let's dive into our story. We'll be looking first at chapter 42 in Genesis. We'll just be moving quickly. Basically, You know already that it was dreamed by Pharaoh that there would be a famine, and Joseph has interpreted the dreams, and he has basically come up with a plan that during these 7 years of plentiful harvest, they would store things, and then during the 7 years of famine that would come, they would be prepared. And so this famine is severe, and Jacob, the family of Joseph, ends up sending his sons to Egypt to buy grain. He doesn't end up sending Benjamin with them because it seems like, you know, he's maybe plagued by the fear of his lost son Joseph, and Benjamin is the same as the next son in line from the same wife, and he that he overly favored Joseph if you were here last time, and he kind of has this attitude again, and so he seems to have a suspicion that harm might happen to Benjamin, so he sends the other brothers. And in verse 6 of chapter 42, it says this: Now Joseph was governor over the land. He was the one who sold to all the people of the land, and Joseph's brothers came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. And Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he treated them like strangers and spoke roughly to them. Where do you come from? He said. They said, from the land of Canaan to buy food. And Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. And Joseph remembered the dreams that he had dreamed of them. And he said to them, You are spies. You have come to seek the nakedness of the land. And they said to him, No, my lord, your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants have never been spies. And so, as you remember, Joseph, 17 years old, young, immature, seemingly callous to the feelings of his brother and his family, had these dreams that basically were interpreted rightly, that his brothers would all be bowing down to him. And that set up basically the story and the way that it went and their actions towards him. But here we see immediately that the brothers come, and here's the fulfillment of that dream, where they bow down before him, their faces to the ground, and Joseph remembers the dream, it says. And I think this must have had a profound effect on him. You know, you remember perhaps that he named his children, speaking of the affliction that he had in the land and the forgetting of his father's house, that he had these wounds from what had happened. And you see that played out here as continually through the story we see Joseph weeping over the situation. And so here he remembers the dreams, but he continues with this sort of outward harshness, and he insists that these guys are spies. And in verse 42:13, it says, They said, We are your servants. We, your servants, are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is no more. And so out of this, Joseph basically sets up a test for his brothers to kind of reveal the truth and test their words to see if they're spies. And he suggests that, well, let's send one of you. One of you brothers will go back, and you can go get this younger brother you speak of to verify whether you guys are telling the truth or your spies just making this stuff up. But he ends up throwing all of them into prison, basically taking them into custody for 3 days. And in verse 18, it says, On the third day, Joseph said to them, Do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers remain confined where you are in custody, and let the rest go and carry grain for the famine of your households. And bring your youngest brother to me, so your words will be verified, and you shall not die. And they did so. So I don't know if the 3 days went by and Joseph just had a change of mind, or if he has had time to contemplate. He's dealing with maybe the emotions over this, and he has devised a plan. Either way, he comes back to them and ends up saying that they can live. He's going to set up a way for them to kind of get off the hook here because he fears God. And I do think that it's the latter, that he has a plan here, as I think we'll see played out. In verse 21, Then they said to one another, In truth we are guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us, and we did not listen. That is why this distress has come upon us. And Reuben answered them, Did I not tell you not to sin against the boy? but you did not listen. So now there comes a reckoning for his blood. They did not know that Joseph understood them, for there was an interpreter between them. Then he turned away from them and wept, and he returned to them and spoke to them, and he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. And so you can see this picture of Joseph when he goes away and he's weeping. These wounds are still there. They're probably ripping open for Joseph as he deals with this. Joseph is going to end up having his servants fill the brothers' bags with grain, and he's going to send them on their way to go bring back their brother. But he also puts all of their money back into their bags. And the brothers along the way end up realizing this. They end up seeing the money, and fear falls upon them. They've already been accused of being spies, and now it's like, oh no, he's going to think we're thieves. How has this happened? And you can see here in verse 28, it says that their hearts failed them. They're trembling. They're saying to one another, what is this that God has done to us? And you can feel the weight of their guilty consciences. They've already been talking about, like, this is the reckoning for his blood. And you think all these years have gone by, you know, so many years, but they have not been able to escape the guilt. They have not been able to escape this burden that they carry. There's been no way to alleviate it. And as soon as trouble comes into their life, the first thing they think is, of course, this is what we deserve. This is the reckoning for his blood. What is this that God's doing to us? And I think this is often what the world does. It tries to deal with guilt in a way that it masks the guilt. You know, we drown the guilt, we ignore the guilt, or we deny that there's any guilt. But at the end of the day, our guilt doesn't really end up being alleviated that way. We can go to soothsayers who just let us feel like we're only victims, and you know, we're always the victims and things like that. But in reality, I don't think that guilt gets dealt with that way. I think it still lingers. It's still there, like it is for these brothers. Kurt Strassner says that in this story, Joseph, you know, with these open wounds, needed to forgive, but his brothers needed to confess and be forgiven. They have this guilt hanging over them. And the story goes on. Simeon gets left behind. The brothers return back home. And in verse 36 of chapter 42, it says, Jacob, their father, said to them, you have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more, and now you would take Benjamin? All this has come against me. So they have explained to their father that they need to take Benjamin back, basically to verify that they're not spies or they're going to be in trouble. And Joseph doesn't want to release Benjamin. And he goes on, then it goes on in verse 37. It says, then Reuben said to his father, kill my two sons if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my hands and I will bring him back to you. But he said, my son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he is the only one left. If harm should happen to him on the journey that you are to make, you would bring down my gray hairs to sorrow to Sheol. So again, I think Jacob seems to have this inkling that these brothers maybe can't be trusted. Here you have Reuben even saying you could kill my own sons and making these extreme statements, and yet it seems that Jacob doesn't trust them. Here Simeon's in trouble, one of his sons, you know, he's in custody, who knows what's going to happen to him, and yet Jacob won't release Benjamin to free his other son, and he still speaks like he did back when he used to talk about Joseph. You remember when Joseph was presumed to be dead before, when the brothers came to him and showed him the bloody coat, that he basically acted like the only son, the only child he had was Joseph, so that when all of the other brothers and the sisters, the daughters were coming to him to console him, he just was like, I just want to die because Joseph is not around. And it seems like he's still having this attitude. He's the only one left. Benjamin is my precious. And we talked about that before, kind of Jacob's idolatry, him putting, first Rachel and then the children, Joseph, and now Benjamin, in this place of trying to fill a void in a disproportionate way, in an unhealthy way. And so he just leaves his other son and goes on about his business. And it just seems like that favoritism repeated. But God is sovereign and he's working here. And this famine is severe. And so they don't go for very long before they've eaten through all the grain. And Simeon still over there God has a plan to continue to work. And so I think it's a picture still of severe situations sometimes having to wake us up. Like when we're clinging to other things, it's not often that we learn things the easy way. I know that in my life, I just learned things the hard way. And God has to use sometimes severe situations and suffering and circumstances like this to wake us up. And I think he ends up doing that in the lives of this family and in the life of Jacob. And so Judah ends up coming during this time to his father and says, you need to send the boy with them. We need to go back. We need to get more grain or we're going to die. Like, you can keep your son here, but we're all going to die anyway. We're going to starve to death. And so Jacob finally seems to break. It finally seems like he realizes to a degree what he's been doing. And he repents or he changes his mind. In verse 12 of chapter 43, Jacob says, take double the money with you. Carry back with you the money that was returned in the mouth of your sacks. Perhaps it was an oversight. Take also your brother and arise. Go again to the man. May God Almighty grant you mercy before the man, and may he send back your other brother and Benjamin. And as for me, if I am bereaved of my children, I am bereaved. And so I think what you see here is Jacob is finally seeming to speak of his children in a plural sense. He finally seems to at least be having a hint of caring for all his boys. He speaks of his children and not just the one. And he's finally willing to allow them to take their brother back and to spare and save the rest of the family. And so the brothers end up getting to Egypt. And immediately Joseph has them brought to his house and has the servants of, you know, bring them in and they're going to dine with me. And their immediate reaction, again, these two guys, guilty conscience, fear comes over them like, oh no, what's he doing? Because they know, they never came back with, the money yet. They've been eating all the grain till it's gone. Some time has gone by. And so they immediately speak up to let him know quickly, you know, hey, we had this money. It was still in our sacks and they're super afraid of being set up for something. And they all end up bowing down before him again in both verse 26 and 28, you know, we see a reiteration of the establishment and the fulfillment of the dreams that Joseph had as God has worked these things. Joseph ends up seeing Benjamin, and in verse 30 of chapter 43, it says, then Joseph hurried out, for his compassion grew warm for his brother, and he sought a place to weep, and he entered his chamber and wept there. And then he washed his face and came out, and controlling himself, he said, serve the food. So Joseph keeps his composure. When he weeps, he ends up going away and doing it not in front of them. But we see that he weeps because there's this compassion growing in him for his brother Benjamin. And it almost seems like a picture of this longing for reconciliation. You almost see throughout this as Joseph continues to go away and weep, there's almost like this seeming longing to say, like, I'm your brother. Like, wanting to be back in with this family, wanting healing to take place. I think that, you know, as I was reading this, I was just, the one question I kept asking myself is, what is Joseph up to here? Because what it looks like is, like, well, the natural thing is vengeance. Like, he's angry because what they did. But when you're really looking at the story, like, is he really? Because everything that he did wasn't really that harsh, and you keep seeing compassion and kindness mixed in here. Joseph, for one, seems to have been a man of immense wisdom, that God gave him immense wisdom. When he interpreted the dreams that Pharaoh had, he immediately had a plan of exactly how what needed to happen. He's governed all of Egypt, basically. And, you know, when he was in Potiphar's house, he was able to oversee that whole house. Potiphar didn't need to have concern of anything. And so God continued to bless Joseph and give him great wisdom. And he continues to have it. And I think that all along, it seems like Joseph is up to something specific and that this isn't random. What's taking place here, according to Tim Keller and Derek Kidner, who has a commentary on Genesis that's really good, is that Joseph is using God's method for breaking his brothers open to God. When you consider Joseph's life and the transformation that we saw in Joseph from being this young kind of punk, spoiled brat, indifferent to his brothers. You know, his brothers are out in the working in the field, and where is he? He's not working. Well, he goes out and he brings back bad reports about them. And he goes and wears his coat that, you know, shows that he's the favorite when he's walking up, and he tells them of these dreams, you know, and he just seemed to have this callousness, and yet then he becomes transformed into like one of the more amazing characters that we read about in the Bible. Joseph, even though I haven't camped on the concept, is very much a type of Christ. And yet the transformation that we saw take place in Joseph happened so much through suffering. And it happened also through blessing. We saw that God would take Joseph down into the depths of suffering and agony and just immense pain, and yet then he would give him favor and immense blessing. And so it was up and down. He would be at the top, and next thing you know, he's down in the prison. And then he'd be at the top again. And so Derek Kidner basically calls this idea the sun and the frost. And you can kind of think of the sun and the frost that breaks up the rock or breaks up the fallow ground. Fallow ground is unused soil that has no growth. In Hosea 10:12, it says, "Break up your fallow ground, for it is time to seek the Lord, that he may come and rain righteousness upon you." And it's this idea of plowing the ground, making something ready for growth and life, and breaking something up. And so Derek Kidner says this in his Genesis commentary. He says, speaking of Joseph and these threats and the way he's interacting with them, "Even the threats were tempered with mercy, and the shocks that were administered took the form of embarrassments rather than blows. A vindictive Joseph could have dismayed his brothers with worthless sackloads or tantalized them at the feast as they had tantalized him." You remember they threw him in the pit and they all sit down to eat a meal. "His enigmatic gifts were a kinder and more searching test. Just how well judged was his policy can be seen in the growth of quite new attitudes in the brothers as the alternating sun and frost broke them open to God." And so, you know, if you're out hiking, and we lived in Bishop, California for about a year, and there's these awesome and beautiful granite slabs and rocks everywhere, and you can hike and you can see some of these rocks that look like someone took like a masonry saw or something, just cut a straight line through them because the rock has been split. And how this takes place is water ends up getting down into these small cracks in the rocks. And during the time where it's maybe cold, but it's sunny. And so the water goes down into a small crack, and then the frost comes and it freezes. And that crack begins to gradually expand. And then the sun comes and melts, and more water comes down into that crack. And eventually that crack widens as it freezes to the point where finally the rock splits. And so I think that this is that idea that the sun and the frost alternating between these things has that effect of breaking, of being able to break open even the rock-hard possible hearts of these brothers. And I think because this is what Joseph experienced, because Joseph in his life understood that this is how God worked in my life, this is how God brought about change for me, he seems to be doing this with his brothers, that he doesn't just come out and say, you know, "It's me, Joseph, I forgive you," but he's trying to possibly help them. I don't want to infer too much, but there's definitely something else going on here. And so Joseph just continues to kind of give them almost the taste of retribution. Like, they begin to fear, like, oh no, you know, we're getting what we deserve now. And then right about that point, he kind of pulls back and softens the blow, the sun and the frost. And I think Keller and Kidner are right about this. I think these brothers are being broken open to God, and they need both forgiveness and healing. Keller argues that these brothers don't just need forgiveness, they need healing for this just open wound that they've been carrying, because they, although Joseph is the victim, they are the victimizers, you know? And many of us, I think, probably carry those things. We've all probably been victims in ways, but if we're honest, you know, we have things that we end up carrying. We have guilts that we carry with us. And God's desire, for one, is not only to forgive us and to grant us mercy and freedom, but to bring healing in the areas of our life and to make us a whole people. So we don't have to go around like these brothers who just, anytime something happens, it's like, oh yeah, of course, you know, I knew it. what we did. It just hangs over them like a burden on their backs. And so as Joseph continues his plan, he ends up taking his silver cup and he puts it in the youngest brother, Benjamin, his brother's sack. And he sets them up. And so the servants come out after them and they have them open all their sacks from the youngest to oldest. And they find the silver cup in Benjamin's sack. And then in chapter 44, verse 14, it says, "When Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, he was still there. They fell before him to the ground. And Joseph said to them, 'What deed is this that you have done? Do you not know that a man like me can indeed practice divination?' And Judah said, 'What shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak? Or how can we clear ourselves? God has found out the guilt of your servants. Behold, we are my Lord's servants, both we and he also, in whose hand the cup has been found.' But he said, 'Far be it from me that I should do so. Only the man in whose hand the cup was found shall be my servant. But as for you, go up in peace to your father.'" And so what Joseph has cleverly set up here for his brothers is a repeat of the same scenario that he experienced when he was 17 years old. Here they have daddy's favorite, you know. They're probably somewhat annoyed by that still in the first place. The only one left, right? And they have a choice now. They have a choice maybe for the possibility of healing and redemption, or they can just do a repeat and sell their youngest brother down the river, because they can go home. They can tell their dad whatever. They already did it once. But they don't seem to want to do that. They've been carrying this guilt, and they seem to learn from their mistake. In verse 33 of chapter 44, Judah ends up speaking. Now, he's already said that if they come back without the boy, that their father will die. And then he says here, "Therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the boy as a servant to my Lord, and let the boy go back with his brothers. For how can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? I fear to see the evil that would find my father." And when it's talking about servant, it really just means slave. Like, this is Judah. Judah is the one who suggested, let's sell Joseph into slavery. He has not been the best character throughout these stories. And here, Judah is saying, "I will be your slave out of love for his father. I don't want to see my father die." I mean, his father is old already, you know. But he doesn't want to see the agony and the pain that he has already seen in his father's eyes because of what they've done. And so he says, "Let me be your slave, send the boy back." And so this is already the beginning of amazing transformation, even in Judah. He's offering himself as a slave to set his brother free, the exact opposite of his attitude before. In verse 1 of chapter 45, we see things just break open for Joseph. He sees the scenario repeated, and he sees the transformation in Judah, and he cannot take it anymore. It says, Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him. He cried, "Make everyone go out from me." So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud so that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard it. And Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. So Joseph said to his brothers, "Come near to me, please." And they came near, and he said, "I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt." So what does Joseph do? He's about to break open. You can just feel the tension. He's been waiting. "I'm your brother." It's like he just wanted to say it the whole time. You can just feel that. And he ends up sending everyone else out, and he's weeping so loud that the household of Pharaoh can hear it. This wound is breaking open as God is bringing healing into this dysfunctional family, and he sends out the servants, and I think that it's very likely that he was doing this to cover the shame of his brothers, knowing that he, during this famine, would like to bring his family home. He would like to provide for them and be a savior to them, because he has the power to forgive them, and it's his desire. And so instead of bringing shame upon them, where the people in Egypt would hear what these brothers did and hate them, he covers their shame. And that's again where Joseph is that type of Christ. Christ who came and covers our shame and our guilt and forgets it. As far as the east is from the west, He removes our transgressions from us. He has no desire to shame us and expose us, but when He deals with us and His discipline is harsh, it's for our good and our growth. And this is God's kind and loving and merciful heart towards us. And so you see the love of Joseph pouring out for his brothers. And he says in verse 5 of chapter 45, "And now, do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land for these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and ruler over all the land of Egypt." And so you see that. You sold me. God sent me. You sold me. God sent me. And it's a reminder to these brothers of their guilt, and at the same time a picture of the grace of forgiveness. These brothers don't deserve forgiveness. They wronged him. They deserve to be enslaved. But they're receiving what they don't deserve, and that's what grace is. And that's what we receive. We receive, when we put our faith in Jesus and we trust Him with our lives, we receive what we don't deserve. We don't earn it. That's why we don't do religion. When we take communion in at the end here, it's not an act of religion or something that we're trying to do. It's worship. It's remembering what He has done already. And that we receive what we don't deserve. And so Joseph, I believe, is able to forgive because he understands and embraces the sovereignty of God. He has continually throughout his life witnessed God's absolute control over situations. Where God can take him and make him the head of a household and then make him an accused rapist in the prison and then make him the most powerful, pretty much, man, you know, in the known world. God is sovereign over the affairs of men, and He understands looking back at his life. He understands looking back at the dreams that it was not you, brothers, who sent me. Yeah, you sold me, but God sent me here. And so in verse 15, Joseph kisses his brothers, it says. He weeps upon them. And after this, his brothers talk with him. And so there's healing taking place. They're coming back together. As the story progresses, Genesis 49, Joseph ends up blessing all his sons. He's already been reunited with Jacob in chapter 48. And, he's seeing the promises come about that God has already given. As God continues to be faithful, it seems in a lot of this narrative that God has been out of the scene for Jacob. You know, where was he when Joseph died? Where are the promises? This family is dysfunctional. It looks like the whole idea of redemption in this big story was about to be to just collapse. And yet here we're seeing the continuation of the fulfillment of the promises of God, that His word stands true. And in Genesis 49, Joseph blesses all his sons, and it seems like he's no longer acting like he only has one son. He does set apart Joseph in a particular way, but it seems like probably more as someone who was set apart by God. But he acknowledges all his children, and so it almost seems like there's a transformation even in Jacob, from this man that put just these sons on a pedestal to a man that probably has had that idolatry of his heart lessened. And so this dysfunctional family has begun to become transformed. And seemingly by the power of the gospel, by the power of forgiveness, by the power of God's grace working in their lives. And then in Genesis chapter 50, Jacob has died, and the brothers begin to become concerned. In verse 15 of Genesis 50, it says, "When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, 'It may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him.' So they sent a message to Joseph saying, 'Your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin because they did evil to you. And now, please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father.' And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His brothers also came and fell down before him and said, 'Behold, we are your servants.' But Joseph said to them, 'Do not fear, for am I in the place of God.'" Joseph, I think, along the journey of his life, has learn firmly that God alone is judge. Joseph is not willing to sit in the seat of God. And he encourages his brothers that they don't need to fear for, am I in the place of God? He says, I'm not God. God can deal with you. You need to get right with God on your own, but you don't need to fear this. And Joseph weeps. I think you can imagine time has gone by and he's weeping that his brothers still feel this. You know, reconciliation has taken place, but what a tragedy that his brothers are still so afraid of him. And I think that Joseph so clearly understood the sovereignty of God because he saw through faith the bigger picture. He saw that God was at work doing far more than just working in this little family. And that's how God operates. When he's working in our lives or in our community, it's not just about like me and my family or us. God is doing so much more than we can ever imagine or see. And we need to know that and trust that when we consider his sovereignty. Joseph goes on in verse 20. And this is central. We talked about this in the last part one of this message. Joseph says to his brothers, as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. And so Joseph, seeing the bigger picture, understood that. You sold me, God sent me. He understood that though they'd worked, you know, this out in their scheming and in their free actions of committing evil against him, that this was also ordained by God. This wasn't an afterthought. This was God's plan. God brought this about. God intended for this to happen. And Joseph understanding that, you know, it just enabled him to be able to understand, no, God sent me and he sent me for good. He meant all of this for good. He meant me to be thrown in that pit and to weep and to have my heart torn open and broken and to be a slave and to suffer the affliction. He meant all of this for good. And Joseph just happened to be able to see the end outcome of the saving of many people. But we have to be able to trust God's sovereignty through faith. This is how God's sovereignty works. You know, God can work within the actions of people who are accountable for what we do and who are free, but God is in control. And the Bible says of all things, Isaiah 46, 9 and 10, God says, I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand and I will accomplish all my purpose. God's purposes cannot be thwarted. But as we talked about, like in the lives of these missionaries who gave up their lives, it just doesn't always go the way that we want. It really isn't our best life now in the sense of the American dream. But it is in the sense that God will accomplish everything that he has planned for us and through us. And we can count on that. It's just not always going to mean smooth sailing. Going back to those missionaries who gave their life up on the beach, Nate Saint, that pilot who invented all these amazing things and pioneered a way to get them on the beach so they would lay their lives down. His son, Steve Saint, would later go and investigate kind of what happened and spend time. He'd eventually end up living with these people and ministering amongst them. When he considered all of the events that went down that led to the martyrdom of his father and these other men, here's what he said. It occurred to me how incredibly unlikely it was that the Palm Beach killings took place at all. It is an anomaly that I cannot explain outside of divine intervention. John Piper, who I got this from, paraphrases it. Did you hear what he said? God killed my father. God killed my father, and he meant it for good. And so Steve Saint would look at these things and just think, you know, this shouldn't have happened. There were all of these events that had to happen exactly the way they did for that martyrdom situation to even take place. Nate Saint had to be the kind of pilot who could land a plane on a beach that he shouldn't even be able to do it. They had to be able to do these things for all of this to come about that God had planned and ordained and meant for these men to make it to that beach so that they could lay their lives down for the guilty, so that they could suffer so that others could be saved. And if you hear that story, you'll know that Nate Saint's sister, Rachel Saint, went out with Elizabeth Elliot and her two children and walked with their children, two women, into the jungles by faith, not knowing what was going to happen, to live with the murderers of their husbands. And Rachel Saint never left. She spent her life there so that these people, the Wildani, could be saved and they could be named among God's people. And so many, probably the majority of this tribe, this head-hunting, murderous, homicidal tribe, have been saved because people believed in the promises of God and they believed that God was the judge. And they believed that God had the power to overcome these things. Jim Elliot, Elizabeth Elliot, who went out into that jungle, her husband said this, and I have it on my wall. I heard it as a young man, my missionary mom. Jim Elliot said, "He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." He understood that if it meant giving up their lives, it's no fool. I know what I'm doing. These men counted the cost. They knew this was a possibility. He's no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. Jim Elliot embraced the kind of bravery that he did along with these other men because he also followed one who gave what he could not keep. Because Jesus came into the world to give his life up. He came to do all that the Father willed him to do. He had no other option. He came to obey, and not my will, Father, but yours be done. Take this cup from me, he would cry out, before he would give his life up, and yet not my will, but yours. And he would give up what he couldn't keep to gain what he couldn't lose. A people, like it speaks of in Revelation, from every tribe and tongue and language and nation who will worship before him. If you watch that movie, and again, I hope you do, The End of the Spear, at the end of it, there's some actual real footage of Steve Saint and Minkaye, I think is his name. And that's the guy who killed his father. And they're in America, and they're in a drive-thru or something, or in a grocery store, and this tribal guy, and he's got the big earrings and just total tribal, he's walking through, and he's like looking at the drive-thru thing or something. They're laughing together. You know, they're laughing like friends. Here, the man who took this boy's father away, so he grew up without a father, you know, and they're friends. And that's the power of the gospel. That's the power of a sovereign God that we have, who has given us a powerful gospel, who has given us immense good news, because we have a missionary God who sends people. And he didn't just send Joseph, and he didn't just send Nate Saint or Rachel Saint or Elizabeth Elliot and her children or all the rest. God sent his own son into the world. God, our missionary God, sent his son so we could murder him. And so we could strip him and whip him and mock him and spit on him. So we could drive the nails through his flesh. So we could cry out, "If you're the King of the Jews, save yourself." And so we could hear him say, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And so we could hear the words, "It is finished." So we could live. And so what we're doing this morning as we wrap up, and Brent, if you guys want to come up here, we're going to take part in these elements of the juice and the bread, representative of our hope, representative of this powerful gospel. Jesus came, sent by God, and gave his life, and his blood washes over our sin. He covers our shame so it doesn't need to be exposed, so we can be set free, so we can receive healing. And when we take part in these things, this is an act of worship. This is an act of remembrance and gratitude of a body broken, represented in the bread, and his blood shed, represented in the cup. And so we just come up, we take these things, go back, and we pray, and we give thanks to God, and then sing together. So I'll close in prayer, and then we'll come up and just have a time of worship and thanksgiving. Lord, I thank you that you are a missionary God, and you've called us to be a missionary people, but not before you demonstrated it in sending your son. And I thank you that your son, Lord, I thank you, Jesus, that you were obedient to the task and that you laid your life down and that you suffered so that guilty sinners like us could be saved, and then we could be set free, and we could be forgiven, and we could leave behind the past, and we could be made whole, and we could be healed, Lord. Help us to have hearts that love you and that embrace the good news of the gospel, Lord. Help us to know you and trust you and bank on your promises. In Jesus' name, amen.